This is Dig and Swing, a volleyball podcast for everyday coaches. So I want to go on to drill planning now because I think they're kind of one and the same. So what I want to first start off with this because it's not even really a drill, but it kind of sets the tone for your practice. One of the common things I see in the VCT group, which is the Facebook group that we're all part of, and you two are awesome admins of, is that they say, my kids just don't seem to have the passion or the drive at practice. They're just kind of playing like they don't really care. And, or they play really well at practice. And then once they get to the game, it's just gone. And so I guess what's the $1 million solution to this? Is it like, how do you foster that competitive spirit in practice? Like, what are some drill ideas, you know, that are going to foster that based, maybe if there's, it differs by age. I see it's a common thing is how to keep kids engaged and practice the way they're going to play, but then they go out there and they don't play that way.
And I think this should start with a lot of things that are assumed. I will give my take, assuming the coach is engaged and they're not leaning against a pole or sitting crisscross applesauce on the ground and just generally listless. Because I think as you go through your volleyball career, you've seen a lot of different kinds of ways to coach, and not every way is successful. So I think as we go through this, none of it matters if you're not engaged. Your kids can only be as engaged as you are. Some outliers. My team, they get excited to competitively color during a tournament. So there's that. So
what do you mean by that?
Oh, like they'll bring coloring books and then compete again. They just love competing to the nth degree.
That is beautiful. They
competitively color. They're 17 years old. It's just who they are as people. But I think there's a lot of the soft skills in practice that once you have the practice plan, you still have to go like do it the right way. So I think the first thing is having an engaging practice plan. If you tell me to go pass the ball off the wall 100 times, I'm going to care for about the first 15. The next 15, I'm going to lose interest. And the last 70, I am just counting down the minutes until this drill's over.
Yep.
But if we can accomplish that same thing where it's a serve and pass and server scores points for X, Y, and Z, passer scores points for X, Y, and Z, suddenly now this looks a lot more like what's going to happen on Saturday or Sunday when we're at Power League. And now I care at a very different level. So, just dressing it up to be competitive goes a long way. Because if you're at a club like the one I'm coaching at currently, and you don't like to compete, it's okay because we didn't take you at tryouts. Where I came from, we had some kids that weren't terribly competitive. They cared. They just weren't the most competitive kids in the whole wide world, but they'd still find something to latch on to. And if a kid genuinely doesn't want to compete, there's probably something going on behind the scenes you don't know about. So that's the conversation to have then.
BJ, what's your $1 million solution to this?
If I had the $1 million solution, I'd already be in Tahiti. So I don't know if I have the $1 million one, but I think this is rooted in the culture of your team. And it's probably a several hour discussion if you're struggling along these lines. But generally, I think, and Pat said one of them, you've got to figure out a way to make it fun, engaging. That's not going to be the same thing for every team, and it's not going to be the same thing for every kid on every team. So that part that's a big part of taking the temperature of your team and your players. Generally, I think that they're number one, looking for some level of competence. I think a lack of competence is gives you the feeling of, well, you know, I'm not gonna do this. Well, the problem with that is most of us have kids that want to learn and they're not competent yet. So I'm working with a Division I team right now, and we just talked about this yesterday, 2 days ago. You can focus on the score, which as you go to higher, I'm gonna say the levels, if you play professionally, the score is very important. If you play in Division I volleyball, the score is very important. But even in Division I, if you're, say you're a seventh or eighth place team, you've still got to find the motivation to go out and compete every day. And I think one of the big ways to do that is to figure out, what are the games within the game? And this is a question for the player. You know, you might say to a middle blocker, what's the game within the game that you can play? If you can avoid the scoreboard for a little while and you're just playing against somebody, what is it? And you would hope to hear, and I don't know what every middle blocker would say, but I would hope to hear from a middle, oh, I want to shut down my opposing middle. I want to make sure that she's not taking free shots into my court, and I want to take some free shots into hers. I want to close to the outside. I want to see if I can get my block closed and timed right, or little things like that. Those breaking down the game into smaller bits seems to be a big motivator for players, especially players that, if you got a player that's struggling to pass, she's working hard on passing, because we all have to. Another way to keep her engaged in practice is to look for a game within the game. If it's an outside hitter, hey, you're work on learning how to tool a block. We know you're working on passing. We know it's a struggle for you, but that's not the only thing you should be working on. Let's work on tooling as well, or let's work on hitting with range a little bit more. I think those are a couple of things that you can do for sure.
Pat had his hand up. What do you
mean? Can you define competence in the manner that you're using it when it comes to drill creation?
Sure. A kid, you know, if you're running, let's just take the extreme. If you have your high school varsity and they're playing against the eighth grade, the varsity is just going to bomb the ball off of the eighth graders and serve. And the eighth graders are never going to serve receive the varsity. And it's going to be completely demotivating. So you could, I wouldn't advocate doing this, but you could figure out a way to have the varsity play the eighth grade. The first thing would be, well, varsity, you have to serve this way instead. You have to serve underhand, or you have to serve left-handed, or something like that, so that you don't totally take the eighth graders, you know, passion away. Now, if we get into something that's a little bit more realistic, if you're on a team and you've got two middles, one's awesome and the other one is up and coming. I've been in this situation a lot of times. I spend a lot more time with the up and coming middle saying, you know, she is really good. You can get there. Let's figure out some ways for you to have that little game within the game. Can you start working on hitting around that blocker to the right side with some pace? Can you hit high hands off of that other blocker? Can you take some space away from her? And we'll judge you on those things rather than, you know, is she zinging the ball past your ear every time? I think just in telling the player what it is that you're going to judge can help that motivation.
Pat, I know we did this at when you came out here and we did my little video thing about the 4 points passing. I find that it's really hard when you, especially when you have the little kids, you know, starting out teaching some basic technique stuff and finding a way to make that competitive. And I think Pat did his 4 point drill kind of helps a little bit with that and making it, you can make it a competition against other people. I think I did that before, but I try to think of like creative ways to make teaching those individual techniques, those basic things, as a competition.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing to do. If you have specific technical items that you want kids to get, that's how you score your drill. We have a couple of drills that we do that are very much like that. There's a technical point, and we have a coach watching one player and another coach watching another player, and those are the only two players getting judged at that moment. And they get scored on whether they're completing this task with the technical technique, or with the correct technique that we're asking for. And correct is a bad word. With the technique that we're asking for. That's, you know, even depending on, or not depending on their success. If the ball comes in, if you want arms straight and simple, the ball comes in, you pass a perfect ball, but your arms were bent and sideways, well, no point. It pretty quickly gets to the point where they're going to go straight and simple if they know that's the only way to get a point.
And that also builds into having a group of kids with the culture of, I want to win. So when you dangle the carrot of wanting to win in a game, and then we can then take that will to, okay, straight and simple arms when we're passing. Okay, I want to win. I'm going to do it. Like, it's very easy to get better at things much quicker when that's how it's introduced, rather than go straight and simple. Why? Because I said so. Like, it's pretty tough to get consistent buy-in across the board when that's the culture.
That's a good point. I think the mistake that a lot of coaches make is that they change the task rather than changing the focus. We know we have to pass a ball, so that has to be the task, is passing. It has to be a serve. And while that serve is happening, rather than changing to an easier serve, maybe you want to change to, we're gonna just focus on one thing in your passing technique today. And that way they're putting the whole technique together. It's one of the big principles is using the whole skill. We're putting the whole technique together, but we're only judging this one little piece of it. And that's all we're focusing on today. So I think that's a better way of getting more out of that kid than to, you know, change the drill for them, make it easier.
Yeah. And I think it's the easier way of putting that sort of competition stuff in it is kind of by playing. And that's something I think, you know, a lot of people will just do some partner passing back and forth, and you could do a little bit of a scoring and have your, you know, the teammate hold you accountable to that and say yes or no, and they get a point. I know for my past team, I had a girl that's a really great setter. She has really great hands, but she had the athleticism to get to a ball that was in the middle of the court where she, you know, out of system, she had the athleticism to get there with her hands, but every time we just go to back to her platform. So what we did was we were keeping track of, in a scrimmage, we're keeping track of the score. And then so I have a flip on the top and then I have a flip at the bottom. And so every time she used her platform, we kept like a little mini score. And so when she got to three, the other team just got a point, a free point automatically. And I told her in a game one time, I said, you're not allowed to use your platform. Like, nope, just, I don't care if you're on the ground and, you know, all sprayed out, just trying to get you have to get your hands on it. And it was amazing how much better she played with that one focus. It didn't even matter. For me, I don't really care about the score that much. I look, and it's important, but when you go to those technical kind of things, that's when I kind of like to add the score in as opposed to the outcome of it, you know, and that kind of goes to that whole process versus outcome and motor learning and whole versus part and all that.
I think another good part of that, Sarah, is asking the player what it is that they want. What do they want to improve? Learning a lot about that type of communication right now from Harjeev Singh, who is...
I love him. He's actually one of my people I'm going to be interviewing too.
Ask him about autonomy. So that's just giving the player the opportunity to say, here's what I want to get better at. And then you as coach can help design the way to get better at that thing. Their interest level goes way up. Their motivation level goes way up. And it's just such a simple thing to give them some control. It should be the main thing that players should have control over their own careers. So giving them that little bit of control is also very motivating for them. So it turns out to be.
Pat, give me a really great drill that you came up with besides Ruckus, because we already talked about that in the other one, that you found was really effective with working on the process.
Probably the four points of passing. Last year, my 15 twos, we were not good at passing. This was a very poor passing team. We, as a coaching staff, got excited when we would pass a 1.88 out of three. That's not good. So driving back to my apartment after a qualifier, and like 3 days of like not sleeping and being frustrated, I called a buddy and who's a volleyball coach. And I'm like, I'm going to verbal vomit a bunch of crap out. I just need you to write it down because I'm pretty sure I'm having a fever dream. And I'm driving, so this is super safe. But it's fine. And I spurt out things I think matter for passers. So in our gym, can you say mine and who you're going to pass to before you pass it? That's the first point. Can you keep your body in the same posture throughout the course of the pass? That's the second point. Can you get your feet to the ball or near the ball and get them stopped before you start using your arms? That's the third point. Can you freeze your platform towards target? That's the fourth point. And so I'm just kind of yelling at him to just write it down. And I went to sleep and I called him back the next morning. And I go, hey, can you read back what I kind of just shouted out at you? And he goes, dude, this is actually brilliant. And I'm like, okay, I still don't believe it. So I kind of gussied up a little bit, talked to Carrie about it. And she goes, no, this makes sense. So then we started working on it. And then suddenly our kids now have very concise things they need to work on. And our passing, we had three tournaments left after that qualifier, and it was the Stars and Stripes tournament, which is basically our pre-nationals tournament, and AAUs, and then the USAVs, and we averaged a 2.3 at those three tournaments. So
that's not bad.
It worked. All right. Yeah, it got better after a month. So it was just the idea of, here are things we need to work on as passers, and we're not going to sweat the rest of it. Because if your hips are a little bit funky, well, that comes from posture. If it's like it, you can kind of cut away a lot of the fat out of passing and just focus on four very basic things that go, it's as linear as you can make a whole skill in my mind. And it doesn't really work, but at the same time, it makes enough sense to the kids. And after that, we then scored, the way we scored it was you would get those 4 points if you did all those four things. But if you didn't do one of those things, the server would get the points that you didn't. So then it got the servers to really pay attention to, when I serve a ball, how does the passer react? And then it made our serving better, because then they started to understand how to blow a serve receiver up or how to make them dive for a ball. So then we became more aware as servers also. So then you kind of had this tug of war action between the servers and the passers, and I think everyone got better for it.
I think a good addition to that drill, or a good thing to kind of look at another when you're talking about the server kind of paying attention to the passer, is it kind of goes to that ball setter, ball hitter. And I mean, we all been playing and coaching for a really long time. And just like that old saying about how coaches know it's a tip before the setter even thought about tipping the ball, we all know we could see it happening. And so, you know, now that you serve and now you're a defender, watching that passer and thinking about what would probably end up happening and trying to be two steps ahead of it. And that's a good like practice and, you know, reading as well. Not that you're going to have a setter necessarily, but in that drill, but I think it's a good kind of introduction to predicting and getting being in the right spot and, you know, kind of reading it a little bit better. So,
well, and I think the ball does a whole lot of good teaching, but you have to know the language of the ball. And if your eyes aren't where the game dictates they need to be at the time the game dictates they need to be there, it's very tough to learn. And like, I think a lot of kids, you know, we grew up, you know, with the sing-along songs of Follow the Bouncing Ball. If that's how you play volleyball, you're not going to learn a whole lot. You know, and it's just getting kids to get good at seeing the people that play the game rather than the volleyball bouncing around. I know BJ's got some good stuff on that.
Yeah, one of the things I actually wanted to ask BJ real quick was, how do you add that in there? I know we kind of talked about it, but in doubles and triples, what would be something that you would add in to make it more technique focused?
Yeah, the biggest thing for us is we put the score on the things that we're looking for. So we spent a year, and this could be another half hour conversation. We spent a year in a cauldron where I worked pretty hard to make the cauldron almost all process oriented. So in every drill that we did, the way we scored it was based on a process rather than on the final score. We call it a dual scoring system. So if we're playing, the person or the team that wins the rally gets to choose if they're going to serve or receive. That's how the rally stays important. But the score is being kept based on whatever it is that we care about. For instance, in our gym, we care a lot about our middle making the correct read, whether the ball is going line or going angle. So we'd have a coach stand back behind the middle, and the team gets a point if that middle back makes the right choice, if they stay on the angle read or if they go to the line read. Then even if they mess up the rally, lose the rally, they still get their point. But then the other team gets to choose, okay, we're going to side, or we're going to receive or serve. Then if we're keeping points on, you know, defending first, well, we want to serve this time. If we're keeping points on serve receive, they may want to receive the next, they want to receive first. So it's a dual scoring system. I found that two is the max. You can't have a third one. That's way too complicated. But two is definitely possible, even for the youngest kids that I work with who are 8 and 9. They can keep that straight.
And you do doubles with 8 and 9 year olds?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all the time.
Jealous.
We change the tools are. We change the ball. We'll change the court. We'll change some of the rules. If they're extremely struggling, maybe we'll allow them to catch a ball from time to time, whether it's, you know, if a ball goes really crazy, they can call it a crazy ball and they can catch it so that the rally can keep going. Or even pick the ball up off the floor, you know, you get your three touches no matter what. You mess up the first one, person that messed it up chases it, brings it back, and tosses a perfect one to the next player. And then they, you know, some of that you can do. I don't like to do a lot of it because I like them to learn the idea that, yeah, you're going to mess up, you're going to fail at this at times, and it's all right. But I think to early on in careers, you got to be a little creative to get rallies going.
And how much success, much success should they have, and how much failure is acceptable?
You know, I think that changes person to person. I hear some people say 2-to-1 successes, but I think it's much more dependent on the kid and how you're framing the success. One of the first things that we talk about with new third graders is you're going to make a ton of mistakes. You may have one or two good plays in this gym today, and we're going to celebrate them like crazy. And you might get a high five from everybody in the gym if you make this one successful play. And especially, you know, with young female participants that are used to playing against the boys and they're getting beat on and whatever else at recess, it's a big deal for them to remember the one success rather than all the failures. So we do some of that. I think that's getting to know your team, and that to me is where the art of coaching comes in, when you're learning about your team and what they can and can't handle.
I love that, because that's actually one of the things that I tell my kids, because I've been doing 14 and under now for the last few years, is we're going to make a lot of mistakes. We're not going to look very good. You know, I tell the parents, 14s, at least for us, don't really look that great until about March. So we're going to celebrate the fact that a player made the correct footwork on a jump float serve, even if it went to the net. And so, you know, we're going to cheer on those things. And I think that it's really important to try to instill that culture at a younger age. I found that when I tried to do that with high school kids, they had already, I have to be perfect. I have to, you know, make my varsity team. I can't make any mistakes. And so my goal as a coach has been to let those 14 and under kids understand that it's a game of mistakes. That's literally how you score. You know, there's only a couple ways of earning a point, and there are a lot of ways to lose a point. So, you know, whoever makes the least amount of mistakes wins, but you're still going to make them. And yeah, I found that it's a lot easier to do that with the little kids. It's my goal. That's my goal, is to make them all just fearless when they get into high school. So
it takes constant vigilance, though. It really does, because and I let our kids know this, you're going to have a bunch of people all day long telling you that you can't make this mistake, that you've done something wrong. But in our gym for these 2 hours, you have to be prepared, and you have to be ready to run towards that mistake and learn from it. And to give you an example from this year, one of our players on our team, who is a big hammer, has been for years, was all of a sudden serving easier and roll shotting, and just unwilling to take that big swing that she had in the past, to the point where both coaches noticed and we asked, hey, you know, is your arm sore? Because you are not the same player that you have been for the last couple of years. And after a conversation, she said, yeah, my varsity coach tells me I got to hit the ball in the court every single time. So I'm practicing hitting it in. And I said, well, I know you can hit it in. So we need you we need your serving percentage to come down a little bit so that you're getting more aces and putting them out of system more. We need you swinging harder so that you're tooling rather than hitting roll shots to the libero. And this is one of the smartest kids I've met in my entire life. You know, she's skipped a grade of school, and she's scoring in the 30s on her ACT. But somebody's telling her, hey, you gotta make fewer mistakes. You know, that's, you know, it's unfortunate.
And I think the silent thing that we're all kind of walking around, because we know it, is we know that if you take a big swing, a possibility is there's a miss. And if we're driving down the road and we see a green light at at an intersection, it's expected that we drive. It would be really stupid to see a green light and stop. So if a kid gets a set and it's a good set and you're in rhythm, take the swing 100% of the time. If you miss that swing, I'm cool with it. You were supposed to swing. Now, if you're a middle and you get a B or an A or whatever, and it's set into your rib cage and you try to thrash the swing, that wasn't the smartest decision. That's another conversation to have. But it's very difficult, I think, for younger coaches. I don't think they realize, and I know I didn't for certain, that all errors aren't created equally, and being mature enough as a coach to understand that's a good swing, that was a good set, and that was a good swing, and sometimes that's volleyball. So if all of the things line up, and then hey, we missed the swing, hey, you missed the swing, like what are you gonna do? So it takes a lot of patience, and I'm sure I chewed a kid or two out that I, you know, looking back on it, should have taken that back and apologized. But that's part of the maturation of coaching.
Yeah. And I tell my kids to go at it and just swing so hard. I just swing hard, you know, especially if you have the best set to go up there. And if it goes out of bounds, I always say, well, the other team had to make a decision as to whether or not it's in or out. And I go, and how many times have we as a team assumed it was going out, do the whole look behind you and go, oh, it's in. And, or they think it's, you know, it's in and clearly it's going out of bounds and they jump up to try to set it. It goes off to their fingertips. So I try to kind of, you know, it's okay to make a mistake because it's, you know, if it's going out of bounds, it's a judgment. They had to make a judgment as to whether, or even if it was wide, you know, and I'm going to take a 50-50 shot on whether or not they're going to make the right judgment. So, okay. Are we ready for the lightning round questions? BJ, you're totally ready?
You bet.
Okay. Favorite volleyball coach besides Pat?
The answer is Sarah.
Oh, shut up.
Volleyball coach. Wow.
Toby.
I love Toby.
All you have to do is mention my wife in case she listens to this. So she's my favorite coach. She hasn't coached for 20 years, but that's number one.
Brownie points.
And then second favorite volleyball coach is... Boy, that's a good question. I really like what, Kessel would be an obvious answer. I like the way he just talks to kids and talks to people. That's right up there as favorites. I'd have a hard time coming up with somebody that I'd like to watch more as a coach, for sure.
Favorite moment for you as a coach? One of the best things that's ever happened to you?
I'll tell you the first thing that there might be a better one, but the first thing I think of is I already get goosebumps when it happens. So we're playing a match and it's a sectional match, which is the second level of matches in Wisconsin. You're a game or two away from going to state, and we get into a fifth game. It's pretty close. We're up, I think we're up maybe 14-12, so we're looking pretty good. Then it's 14-13, it goes to 15s. I think we get to, I think we it's 16-15. We serve, get a ball back, our middle tips a ball, it lands, and it's pure pandemonium in the gym. And I look over, and our libero and our outside hitter are locked in a hug, and they're jumping up and down at the same time and spinning around, and they're both crying, and they look so happy in that moment. I actually watched it a couple weeks ago. I found the videotapes from then. That's how long ago it was. It's on an actual videotape.
Wow.
And I watched it, and I'm like, I got the same feeling as I did in that gym, just watching them jump up and down and spinning and crying at the same time. I mean, I have probably a dozen like that, but that one, when it's two players that are so happy, they've forgotten everything else except that, you know, they're in each other's space and really just enjoying that moment. That was pretty special.
What do you think has been your best timeout motivational quote speech? What has been the best timeout talk you've had?
I'll give you two. One is, we're playing a really bad team and we know we're going to just crush them. And I'm doing everything I can to keep my team focused and serious. And they come over to the huddle and I say, hey, now, you're an all-star. Get your game on.
Go play. No.
This is awesome. Oh, so they all start laughing and they break up and then we go and just crush this team. That was awesome. But a better one that I wouldn't use anymore. Cause I don't like using injury necessarily as a motivator, but I said to my team, just loved that I said this. We're in a super tight match again. It's at the end of the year, state, not at state, but in the state playoffs. And it gets down to, we're at like 14-14 in the fifth game. And I think they come over for a timeout. And I said to him, look, the bruises will heal and the skin will grow back, but you're never going to dig that ball again. And they went out and they won the next 2 points. And they talked about, they still say that to me. when they come up to me now. I don't think it's necessarily the right message from a coach to go get that bruise or go hurt yourself, but my players loved it.
Most oddball outside the box thing you've done as a coach?
We were going to play a state champion in the state tournament. So they had won a couple championships before. It was Halloween, and I was looking for anything to motivate the team, or just, you know, they're nervous, and just to kind of get them a little bit. So my dad has a full size crystal ball, and I went and got this crystal ball from him. I mean, it's like 8 or 10 inch diameter crystal ball. So I go and get this crystal ball from him. I buy a cheap wizard hat that has the hair coming off and everything. So it's got all the big long hair. And
you have a picture of this.
I really wish I did. The hat's around here somewhere. This is probably 20 years ago. The hat's around here somewhere. So I get the crystal ball, the wizard hat. We get on the bus and all the stuff's in my bag. And I'm sitting up front always because I want them to have their own time in the back. And we get maybe 3/4 of the way into an hour bus ride. And I get out the spirits to glue on the mustache. And I glue on a mustache and really long white beard and put the hat on and grab the crystal ball and go walk into the back. You know, because it's Halloween, you dress up. And I said to him, I'm predicting great things for you tonight, holding this crystal ball. I mean, they're just dying laughing, right? But you know, they loosened up, and of course we still got killed by this state champion, but at least, you know, we had that little moment, which that was pretty odd.
I wish you were my coach. That would have been so much fun.
We had some pretty good times. Yeah.
So what's one thing you wish you could change about the sport, whether it's philosophical, a rule, something that's commonly done right now?
I would like for every kid to have the chance of having a good coach. I think there are so many coaches out there that are coaching the way they used to coach or coaching the way they were coached, and they're not paying enough attention to the athletes that they have in the gym, or they're using antiquated methods of, you know, punishment and running and threats and yelling and all that kind of stuff. I wish every kid could go to their middle school and high school and club team and afford the club team that has a great coach on it that's reasonable and that's studying the game a little bit and isn't overcomplicating. You know, I think a lot of coaches just overcomplicate the game when it's pretty simple. You know, you can split up and play doubles or triples. And I make the comment that if more people just played doubles and triples in their practices, that'd be better than about 95% of the practices that I see.
Absolutely.
That'd be my big change for the game, if I could.
Pat, do you have any questions?
No.
A man of few words.
We answered them all.
I already came up with like 3 other episode ideas. So, you know, we can include Pat or not, because Pat's disposable.
So we've been inspiring, not only informative, but inspiring.
Exactly. Well, thanks again, you two, for joining me, and we'll see you next week.